5. The Apostolate. The apostolate refers to those who already have the faith. It is well to know that all the monasteries, both of men and women, for 1,000 years, from the middle of the 6th to the beginning of the 16th century, were in large measure havens, schools, you might almost call them nurseries, for the young, who would be placed there by their parents. Then among those who were there, not a few would then join the respective community. This is Boniface, or Broderick writing about Boniface. He found his vocation very precociously, for we are told that he made up his mind to be a monk. Cum, let me read the Latin. He doesn't even give the English. Cum esset honorum circiter quatuor seu quinque. He decided to become a monk when he was about 4 or 5 years old. And a monk he became. He had made up his mind before, today we're saying, most people reach the age of reason. And a monk he became, or at any rate, a monk in embryo. An oblate of St. Benedict, at the age of 7, he left home. To the great sorrow of his father, who had pinned all his worldly hopes on this extraordinary child. And he lived to the ripe old age of 77. He never lost sight of his Benedictine vocation. Okay? What I wanted to point out, however, is that there is need for the apostolate to go beyond just the confines of the monastery. There were faithful all around. What do we do with them? Do we just pray for them? In other words, education as an apostolate in the Catholic Church grew out of Benedictine monasticism after it was discovered, no great discovery, that many more needed a good religious training than the few that could squeeze into wherever a boy of 7 would be put into a monastery. And that, by the way, was common practice. One thing we need to look into, since this is a course in the history of religious life, we should all re-examine, especially major superiors, the preparing of young people when they're still very young for a future religious life. Today's world and its pressures are too much, I'm afraid, for many what would otherwise have been good vocations. Finally, evangelization. Evangelization differs from the apostolate in that it is addressed to those who are not yet Christian. And thus, in Boniface would be a case in point. All the great missionaries of the early church, I'm talking about after apostolic times, with Paul, Barnabas, and the rest of them, they were, after the liberation of the church under Constantine, and certainly after Benedictine monasticism became established, they were all is too strong. Most of them were religious, who heard by that time of the number of people who had never heard of Jesus and Mary, whom they sought out, often going to uncharted and unknown lands, cutting down the forest, building some semblance of a hut, and beginning to recite the divine office with just the wind blowing through the trees around them. And in time, people were first curious, then interested. And by the way, the number of martyrs that the church had from those early monks and nuns, much of that we don't even have record of. All we know is they kept pouring in more. One wave would die or be killed, another wave would come in order to evangelize a still heathen people. That's what Boniface did. And remember, what color vestments do we wear for St. Boniface? Remember? Red. He was one of the thousands, literally, of martyr monks who, in seeking to evangelize, paid with their lives. Okay? The either Reformation or Reformation. It took three principal forms, and all future derivatives somehow come from these three. There was, first of all, the Benedictine tradition itself, purified, amplified, but essentially Benedict. And all that we've seen about Saint Benedict applies here. Second, the Cluniac, C-L-U-N-I-C, Cluniac Reform. And the third, the Cistercian. Let me say just a word about the second two, because we've already handled the first one, except for such adjustments as we implied in the last 15 or so minutes. The Cluniac Reform is named after Cluny, a city in France, to be exact, in the district of Aquitaine. Date of its beginning, 909 A.D. Founder, Blessed Berno, B-R-N-O. What the Prince of Aquitaine did was to recommend, and then Berno took him up on it, that he, the abbot of Cluny, would be exempt both from his civil jurisdiction and from the jurisdiction of the bishop, and to be directly responsible only to the Pope. What the Cluniac Reform did was especially to cope with the problem of dismemberment and disarray through a lack of authority, with monasteries mushrooming all over, often ill-formed, poorly conceived, with abbots who shouldn't have been abbots, and monks that shouldn't have been monks or nuns. Here are some features of the Cluniac Reform, which of course affected both the men and the women. All the members of all monasteries, no matter how many were formed, and one figure that I have in my mind is 700 at one time, they were all subject to Cluny. Well, that was a far cry from the abbot as father. You don't run 700 monasteries as just a loving father. You exercise jurisdiction. You give orders. You become, in effect, the general of an army. Moreover, not only were the monastery subject to the abbot of Cluny, all the abbots were appointed by him. And I like to say they could also be disappointed by him. Meaning they could be removed by him. The vows which were pronounced by all members of what later came to be known as the Cluniac Order, or the Order of Cluny, were the vows were to be taken and received by the Abbot of Cluny. Another reason for going in this direction was to take care of the evangelization and the apostolate. Then the Abbot of Cluny could say, there are people in need in whatever town or country. You go there, the church needs you. And they went. They better go. And not just among Christian peoples, but even into foreign, pagan lands. The monks therefore became, in large measure, teachers and missionaries. At the same time, perhaps we might think somewhat strangely, the Cluny Reform elaborated and developed the divine office, made it more solemn, to be sung in choir, and talking to monks who sing their office in choir, they tell me 4 hours is not unusual. 4 hours a day, you know, with all the ritual that for a solemn office this requires. Of course, their churches became cathedrals. And the stress in their relationship to God was on the divine majesty. And some of the great figures in the Cluny order, which is a Benedictine derivative, are among the greatest intellectuals in the church's history. I happen to have mentioned 3 outstanding names: Dunstan, Oswald, and Ethelwald. That's for England. The other was the Cistercian Reform. The date here is 1098. The place, of course, is Citeaux, again in France, but in the district of Burgundy. And the one who began it was the abbot, St. Robert, originally of Molem. M-O-L-E-S-M-E. To see what happened, if you can place the Cluniac rule into a mirror and look into the mirror, that's the Cistercian. It's just the opposite. The very thing that the Cluny people stressed, as assertions opposed. The first major polarization in the history of religious institutes. Thus, instead of expanding monasteries and then centralizing them under one head who then became, for all practical purposes, a superior general, the very expression we owe to Cluny. Now, as you can see, for example, you speak of Mother General, don't you? We talk about Father General. You see what we've done? We've combined the Cluniac and the Cistercian ideal somehow. You get it? But the combination is not easy to live out in practice, especially as communities become large, like my own. There were several emphases in the Cistercian reform. First, the asceticism of Saint Benedict was, if anything, intensified, and bodily mortification became part of the Cistercian way of life. What well-known branch of the Cistercians is well-established in the United States? The Trappists. All right? Asceticism, especially on its bodily side, was intensified. And it reminds you a great deal of Antony. Remember his struggles in the desert? Correspondingly, solitude. And as much as that could be done, the solitude of the eremitical life would be preserved even though you had a community. And one way of preserving solitude was forbidding the monks to talk. So the stress on the eremitical, the solitary, the denial of communication, which is a means of recreation, as we know, and more than that, of great pleasure and legitimately. So the whole spectrum of asceticism. Secondly, the tendency towards the more eremitical view. Thirdly, and with great emphasis, poverty. The third large area of reform and development in the Cistercian tradition was poverty. Therefore, simplicity, the bare necessities in food, clothing, shelter. Who is one of the outstanding Cistercians of all time? Saint Bernard. I know how much of him, by what you've read, I think you read a good deal. You got the idea? Even the house of God was not to be too elaborate, right? And he had some really strong homilies about fancy churches. Well, it's good to hear that. This is a way of life. So poverty in all of its forms was stressed in the Cistercian tradition. Manual labor. Where in the Cluniac reform, they became interested, understandably, in preaching and evangelizing, the Cistercians, not being so concerned, as we've just earlier said, in traveling, in fact, quite the contrary, in staying put. Their apostolate would be mainly the apostolate of holiness. They did not entirely exclude the apostolate of service, but they felt that was not their charism. You see how important it is to know the charisms of these founders? Take, you know, the saints. Well, in both cases, we've got some of the greatest saints in the monastic history, either founders or early pioneers in the Cluniac tradition and in the Cistercian tradition. The ones couldn't make their churches elaborate enough. Ornate, all the marble and silver and gold you can get. Nothing is too good for God. The Cistercians, bare walls, plainness, nothing that should delight the eye. It must all be spiritual. Right? And, believe me, if you've got a vocation to the one, you don't have a vocation to the other. All right? How important it is nowadays to know who we are. For the Cistercians, and St. Bernard would be a classic instance. It is said of him that for 12 years, every day, he meditated on the infant Jesus. Littleness, helplessness, poverty, simplicity. All right? But this same Christ child is the Lord of heaven and earth. God wants to be worshipped, and Christ wants to be followed by different people in different ways. Am I clear? So we make no mistake, provided there's sincerity, a heart seriously intent on loving God and becoming like Christ, communities are supposed to be different. But it's well to know that each community understands what it's supposed to be. And when you mix breeds, you've got trouble. Manual labor, therefore, to close with that in the Cistercian tradition, was and remains to this day the ideal, the divine office, and work with one's hands. This is, I think I indicated earlier, was one of the reasons for the crisis in the Trappists, who were in the Cistercian tradition. As I learned from personal experience, having worked with the Trappists, and the history shows it. The largest loss of any major order in the church in modern times has been among the Trappists. Percentage-wise, larger than the Jesuits, though numerically ours is the biggest because of our sheer numbers. And their problem, almost the center of their problem. Not a few vocations enter them, highly gifted, talented, articulate people. In any case, the Cistercian tradition, I am confident, is once more recovering itself. It is an authentic tradition of the Church. And if we said what we did regarding St. Benedict, that is, he is the Father in God of all religious sins, so these two branches of the Benedictine monasticism are our respective parents in God. And you can tell immediately, communities more along the active, external, apostolic, evangelization, educational line, and those more the interior, the cloistered, the contemplative, the secluded, the sacrificial life.